I have often felt less than satisfied because of what I felt I had to do. So I know, to some extent, I'm keeping the faith with the people who have yet to be heard. It's easy to expand, but you're still in the same time. So I'm particularly wanting the next group of speakers to have the time to at least present some of their ideas. Before I ask Charles Kavanagh to do the informal introductions, what we're seeing as we come to the end of this program is the very important pieces that go into this puzzle of trying to fight false memories and false accusation. You need scientists, you need clinicians, you need lawyers, you need people like the siblings and the families, and you need people who could tell these stories to the mass audience out there who thankfully are not harmed by these. And I couldn't be happier to know that the foundation is going to be able to hear from an example of some of these people. And I'm only going to take one other second here, and that's to thank you for the wonderful cooperation you have given me and for the many words of support I hear in the hallways, on the way to the men's room, or whatever, you know. You're such a great audience to be with. Thank you very much for your cooperation.
Good morning. I'm Charles Kavanagh, board member from California. Just think fundraising. You know, what a wonderful opportunity it is to be able to introduce one of the people in this world for whom you have the highest regard, respect, esteem. Eleanor Goldstein is truly one of the remarkable people that I've had a chance to know in my lifetime. This woman was here for us in the beginning, and she's still here. For those of us that got started years ago, if you didn't go back too far, you had confabulations, and boy, you held on to that probably as tenaciously as other people were holding on to courage to heal. And so, well, from the very beginning, she was here for us. And you know, Joan and I out in California a few weeks ago were at a program where Beverly Sills, she wasn't singing, but was talking. And as I listened to that woman, I sort of swelled with pride being a member of the human race, because she is such a great example of what human beings can do. She's an extraordinarily accomplished person. She is a mother and wife, active family member. But her concerns have gone beyond her career and her home to embrace the overall community. She and her husband have been active in many organizations. As I was sitting there listening to this remarkable woman talk, I was thinking, you know, she reminds me of Eleanor Goldstein. I don't know if Eleanor can sing as well as that woman. But you know, I doubt that she can run a business as well as Eleanor Goldstein can. Eleanor Goldstein grew up in a generation following the Second World War that felt it had an obligation to help change the world. Well, let's take a look at this woman and see to what extent she has lived up to that goal which so many people of her generation had. Eleanor was educated at University of Colorado. She got her bachelor's and master's there. She did a brief stint at Cambridge and became a teacher. And while she was teaching, she came up with, she was very concerned about discussion of critical social issues. And she developed a concept for gathering material together which would be used in an educational environment, particularly in classrooms. And that was the nucleus of the set of ideas that caused the formation of SIRS, which began there and has expanded and expanded. It's included the embrace to our concerns here, as you know, from all the publications that Eleanor has had come out. Today, she and her organization have even written and translated into Russian a textbook on economics. Thank goodness.
That's why they're in so much trouble.
Well, I suspect that things are not always calm around you, Eleanor. Her concerns, her social concerns, her concern for social justice certainly has been felt in our organization. But you know what I want you to recognize about this woman is she is a woman of very broad concerns. She served on many boards of directors, and those of you who have done so know that when you serve on a board, you're there for your wealth, wisdom, and work. And I'm sure that she has contributed all three at every organization that she served on. And it's the usual organizations that educated people get involved in, art music, served on boards of for art museums, colleges, symphonies, but also for housing for women problems for women and housing for workers. This remarkable woman was here for us in the beginning. She's still here. And I suspect that she will be here working in our behalf as long as we're in existence. It's with great pleasure I give you our friend.
Can I say after that? I think I'll just sit down. That was wonderful. Thank you. Soon after the formation, as a matter of fact, I met Pam even before FMS was officially formed. And Pam started sending me letters because we met through a rather circuitous route, but we met finally after hearing about each other in Washington, D.C. And then we both happened to be there and we decided to meet each other. And then Pam started sending me letters from families, and people started writing to her soon after the foundation was formed, and these incredible stories that families wrote needed to be told, and they needed to be further disseminated. That information had to come out. Now remember, 7 gay men developed a strange immune deficiency disease, AIDS, and they called it an epidemic. So by the time we had 20 stories and more, we knew that something was emerging. And then, of course, the stories kept coming and coming until I think Pam documented well over 20,000 cases, at least stories that came to her. So we know that if there were 20,000 cases, there were far more than that. Well, from the stories that Pam sent to me, they were so remarkable. They were so amazing. They caused us all to lose sleep. I mean, how could this strange thing be happening to people all over the country? These 20 families were not related. There were 20 separate stories, each individual, and yet each were the same. So when Pam sent me the stories, we started to do the research and say, where is this all coming from? And as we did the research and we read the literature, whatever there was that was prepared, much of it by the Minnesota Ministries, and we'd get your publication of issues in child abuse accusations, where is all this coming from? And so we collected the stories, and a word that I kept seeing over and over again in the psychology literature was confabulations. That's what people do. We all do it. Nobody knows that they're doing it. And if you ask people, when I would talk to a group of people and say, what is a confabulation, no one would give me an answer. They did not know, and yet we all do it. And a confabulation is a mixture of fact and fantasy to create a new memory, and that's what these people in this type of therapy were doing. They were mixing maybe some fact, but certainly a lot of fantasy, and creating memories that they thought were real. So I had to tell those stories. If you have a printing press and you have some stuff, aren't you going to put it on that printing press? And the purpose of these books was to get information to, in the mission that was first established by the FMS organization, to educate professionals, the media, and to work on the behalf of parents. That was the goal of this first book. 20 stories written by parents. Now, you wonder, did only good writers write to us? Because all the stories were so compelling and so interesting. And then we found some basic themes which we've analyzed what might create this milieu in which false memories could be created. And we said the New Age movement, the recovery movement, the fundamentalist movement, and the radical feminist movement. Everybody got mad at me. I was attacking everybody, right? I mean, how many feminists are there in this audience? And how many people that had codependency or alcoholism themselves, you know? And New Age, aren't we all a little New Age? I must admit, I even read my horoscope. I mean, how many of us have a little... So all of the factors, all of these groups of this decade, of the past decade, we all believe in it. And here I was attacking it all. So you can see I wasn't very popular, but that's where the story was. Okay, soon after, Pam said to me, by the end of this year, she said we'd have 2 dozen retractors or something like that, and they were closer to 50 or 100, some statistic like that, but she knew retractors were coming. We had to put the stories of the retractors together. Again, compelling stories, so we did this book. And then Pam, many of you and other people throughout the country kept sending Pam cartoons. Now, we knew that once a cartoonist can do a cartoon, what does that tell you? It tells you there's enough public awareness of the issue, or you wouldn't laugh. You wouldn't understand the joke. So she kept getting all these, and Pam kept saying, I want to do something with these cartoons. I went up to Philadelphia, and she had like 2 loose-leaf notebooks, this thick, full of mimeograph copies of cartoons. We went through them, we organized them, and surely they fit into these major themes we had already identified. The feminist movement, the New Age movement, the recovery movement. Cartoonists were writing about them and joking about them. And those of you that have been to Pam's presentations know that she has a great sense of humor and always carried cartoons with her. And this is the kind of one. Look, recovering memories. Careful, Dad. I feel a future repressed memory of my unfortunate childhood beginning to form. This is a kid who's being mischievous, and he tells that to his father. If you can do such a cartoon, that means people are beginning to understand what repressed memories are, so they fit all the themes. Well, a whole body of literature has developed because of this tremendous crisis. People have responded, and here are a few of the authors who have made great contributions, and there are many more. So, but you know what? Some of the recovered repressed memory people told me that when they first heard they had repressed memories, they went to the library to look for books, and they couldn't find any about repressed memories. And now, all these books are there. There's a body of literature, and the importance of the literature, I think, cannot be ignored. Now, we don't sell a lot of books, any of us. Nobody's gotten rich off the books they've written. But they've made an impact because people have something that they can refer to. So the first book, we're going to go in a little chronological order. We each have a few minutes to present their story. And what they're going to tell you is why they wrote the book and the premise of the book, what it's about, and maybe a little bit of the feedback about what impact they think their books have had. So we're going to start with the person who had experiences far and along before we even recognized what false memories were, because she had some true memories and wrote about that. So from her true memory, she can distinguish between a true and a false memory, right? So that's what Charlotte's going to tell you about her book. You can either speak there or here.
Hi, good morning. Gee, someone who's shorter than I am. Or my daughter calls me. Oh, I've had that effect on people before.
sorry. I do. Can you tell I used to be an entertainer? I'm going to do this very quickly because I promised Mark he could have some of my minutes. Basically, I will just give you a very quick synopsis of how I came to be where I am today. And actually, I am the one person here who makes a great deal of money off publishing. My father died in 1970, and I immediately sat down to write a book about my experiences as an incest victim from the time I was 7 until I was 17. It took me 10 years to get the book published. Oh, big surprise. And people kept saying, well, you know, ooh, sorry, but we like your writing. And I decided that I would become a successful author, and then they would have to publish the book. And indeed, Daddy's Girl was the 15th book I published. I had no idea when I published the book in 1980, I thought I was doing a good thing. I thought that I was bringing a very important subject out of the closet that would benefit literally millions of women, men, children who were being abused. That has been, always will be, my prime focus, is that children are abused every day of the world, and my primary argument with the whole recovered repressed memory issue is that the attention has been taken away from the children who most need it. I have written a lot of pieces for various of the false memory groups around the world, and this is a piece that I wrote for Felicity Goodyear Smith for her New Zealand journal. Last night I had a little epiphany because I've been guarding the pieces that I have written for the journals very carefully because I didn't want to give the other side, as we shall call it, any more ammunition, because they've already used my book as a handbook on how to be a victim, which really deeply offends me. It takes away from people who have truly suffered a terrible loss of childhood, loss of privacy, loss of self, loss of self-esteem, loss. However, I suddenly realized that if they take this piece seriously, it will put an end to the movement altogether. And I thought, well, okay, then let's print this everywhere. I've been talking with sexually abused people for almost 40 years, having decided very early on that once I'd broken my silence, it could only work to the good to keep on talking. My feeling was that the worst thing that could happen to me had already happened, so aside from the possibility of some mad person murdering me, nothing more terrible could result from my telling people about my childhood. I say this in order to illustrate that I have spent most of my life talking to men, women, and children about our experiences of incest. Often, I was the first person ever to speak openly to these people about the matter, and through time, a certain fundamental sameness in our behaviors began to become clear to me. I will outline the aspects of that sameness in order to contrast them to the differences I've perceived in the recent crop of new victims. I have noticed that the old victims are angry people, but our anger is directed primarily at ourselves. Invariably, we hold ourselves responsible for the incest. Something about us, our bodies, our eyes, our mannerisms, our sauciness, something we said or did or thought caused the incest to happen. Because we were children and therefore powerless to protect ourselves, we obeyed. Because the adult in question refused to acknowledge that what was happening was wrong, and we too knew it was wrong, our only alternative was to believe that because we obeyed despite our knowledge of the wrongness, we were therefore somehow complicitous. While we had anger toward the offending party, the bulk of our anger was strenuously, often violently, directed at ourselves. I've met a number of cutters and slashers, people who repeatedly injured themselves, creating pain to deal with the pain. The new victims, on the other hand, do not blame themselves. Rather, they blame anyone and everyone else. This failure to hold themselves responsible all but shouts at me. It is in defiance of everything I've come to know about sexually abused people. We old victims spend much, if not all of our lives, drowning in shame for the reasons I've stated above. The new ones seem, if anything, proud of their status as victims. They like to beat up people with their victimhood, raging loudly about it, while we old ones spoke and still speak in hushed, shameful, choked tones about what we've experienced. We take no pride in having lived through an experience that deprived us of everything from our privacy to any respect for our own bodies. We old victims wanted at best an apology,
acknowledgement of the truth of our experience, and open acceptance of our reality by our families. We want to be loved because we have felt unloved and unlovely. The new ones want vengeance. They blame everyone indiscriminately, wanting public recognition, money, trials, and complete severance from their families. They want to be elevated by their new status, to be within their lifetimes enshrined as victims. We old ones wish as few people as possible to know of our horrible experiences. We don't want anyone to know what we allowed to be done to us. New victims are loud, proud, and massively contentious. They don't demonstrate any of the fears and phobias I still, to this day, experience. I think this can only be because their suffering has all been imagined and implanted. Only people who have experienced long-term subjugation and gradual loss of self can truly know and feel the lengthy roster of secret fears we spend the remainder of our lives trying to overcome. And no book, no therapist, no one can successfully coach another into true victim status. It's somewhat of an intangible, I grant, but I have no difficulty recognizing my fellow victims. There is something in our eyes, in our manner, in our very bodies when we prepare to broach the subject. And the new victims cannot act out these behaviors because they and their therapists are simply unaware of the codes we old ones have implanted in our brains that allow us to know each other. There is no aha when talking to someone with recovered memories. Yet it's always there when I talk to someone whose memories are, for want of a better word, intact. Perhaps, after all, as the cliche goes, it takes one to know one. And that's kind of an arrogant sounding statement to make, but for decades now I've been able to know the ones around me. I can pick it out of the air around people almost like an electric current or an aura. We exude a certain hurt that is almost tangible. There is a lot in life that can be faked, and a lot of fakes manage to pass muster. But I keep wondering what, in all of this horror of imagined history, is being accomplished. Who benefits? As far as I can see, no one at all, except some so-called therapists who are reaping cash rewards for convincing gullible people that black is white.
I'm going to stay seated because I fear if I stand up, this whole thing is going to collapse. It's a bit shaky. And I don't have any prepared remarks, which is a little bit dangerous in terms of time consumption. But Eleanor wanted us to speak about motivation for writing and impact. And I think they're, in a way, related and intertwined. So, by the way, Mark's book came out before mine did, but I guess the decision was the first chapter of my book, which came out publicly in a fairly large circulation newspaper, the Chicago Tribune Sunday Magazine, was prior to Mark, in fact, cited in Mark's book, and then Mark's book is cited in my book, so we all worked together there. But the first publication that really had an impact on me was the cover article in the New York Times, January something, 3 maybe, of 1992. As many of you probably did for a while, my completely alienated, ostracized from my family, and it's something you don't tell your best friend that you've been accused of sexual misconduct. So I had actually told a couple best friends and a couple members of my family, but that was it. And I had moved, I was living alone, and I was very much isolated. And then I saw this publication, New York Times. Some of you will remember it. I think we passed it around for a while. Beware the Incest, a Recovery Machine, Carol Tavris. Wonderful article that let me know, first of all, you're not alone. I thought this damn thing was happening to me alone. It was crazy. But I found out about the other publications, both that were influencing people to claim false memories, such as Courage to Heal, of course, but others as well that were looking at the other side, of course, I didn't know anything about it. So when I did publish this, a friend of mine who had an N with the editor of the Chicago Tribune magazine which has a circulation, by far the most influential or at least widely read place that I've ever published. I think it reaches 1.6 million people in the Midwest, but I was starting to get calls from New York and Los Angeles. Hollywood wanted to do the story, of course. Not my version. They didn't want me to write it, but they they wanted to write it and have it be the movie of the week or whatever. But I also had given out my name. It was published under a pseudonym originally, and I did not give out my name publicly, but I did to the local FMS chapter, our Illinois, wonderful Illinois people, and my phone started ringing off the hook at 8 o'clock on that Sunday morning. I think my first call was from Patty Burgess, who many of you know, of course. She unfortunately couldn't be here this weekend, but and I probably talked with Patty for an hour and a half, and she was really just coming out of her problem, her long problems with Bennett Braun, who I haven't heard mentioned this weekend, but he should have been mentioned. Okay.
He was mentioned. They took away his license.
Yes. And so I think, you know, I flatter myself that I had something to do with Patty going after Bennett Braun initially. And of course, she had something to do with my turning this article into a book. For those of you, it's Lost Daughters, and I don't need to say too much about it, except that what I did in there was take the stories of six families, including my story, which is first in the book, Liz and Roger LaPlante, and Leo and Katie Spanuelo. I should say something about them and thank them publicly, because they've been with us from the beginning, and before I was, with Pam and everybody else from the beginning. And in fact, the book title comes from a phrase that Leo said to me when referring to the psychotherapeutic community, who thought they were going to ignore us. Leo said, "We're not going to go away. We lost our daughters. You know, it's very simple. We're not going to go away." So I take these stories and then intersperse each even number chapter is an analysis of the cultural background out of which existing in our country and our times in North America that have made it possible for this to flourish, I think. So I'm not going to go further about the book than that, but about the impact, two little stories. I was invited shortly after the book came out to speak, read from the book, sign copies, talk, you know, have a Q&A at my sister's church. She was associate pastor of a church in Palo Alto. Just down the street is an organization, literally just down the street from her church is an organization of, I've forgotten the name of it, but it was Abused Women Network or something like that. But these were not real victims of abuse. They were fake victims of abuse. That's just for shorthand. And they were kind of a support group for Eileen Franklin Lipsker. And they came to the church, marched over to the church, and said, "What are you doing allowing this guy to speak in your church?" And my sister, who's pretty feisty, said, "Well, you know, because I want him to." And but they went to the senior pastor, and who is her boss, and he agreed to with them that they would have a spokesman from their group come and speak a month later. So that was fine. But only about 12 people showed up, and I was introduced and announced to this huge congregation of 400 people or 450 people, and I think something like 12 or 13 showed up. So it wasn't it was a hostile environment. At least they didn't picket, which they threatened to do also. Funny thing that was, they sent their my sister sent me their newsletter, and I sent it on to Pam, and I think you probably didn't know about it at the time, but they were bragging in one of their little stories that they had successfully picketed a FMS representative who was signing at a bookstore, and I'm pretty sure it was when Mark and Eleanor had gone to the Santa Cruz bookstore, in Santa Cruz. So you know, it everything dovetails. But anyway, I had some questions and answers from the audience, and really had made some impact with a couple of people who did not who did not know what to do. They showed up just because they were curious, and they were affected. And somebody who never said introduced herself to me at the time wrote me about 2 weeks later, at least when I got home, I got this letter, and it said, your appearance and your book have made a major impact on my life. And that was Leah Franklin. Never met Leah until 2 days ago. And I've got to tell her and tell you that the most difficult thing that I ever did in my life, which is write this book, was all mitigated, and it made it worthwhile for her to say that, for one person to say that, and that it was Leah was all the more sweet. And now, of course, Leah, as you know, has become something of an activist, and I flatter myself that I had something to do with that, or the book did. We as authors have been impacted by a lot of stuff out there. It's not just our books, obviously, and I've read just about everything that's been written on the subject. The wonderful stuff from our speakers in the past couple of days and at the professional conference. Last personal note, my lost daughter, to whom the book is dedicated, about 2 weeks, and many of my Illinois friends know this, about 2 weeks or 2 months after the book came out, I think coincidentally, called me on the telephone. And it was 8 years since, I didn't even know she was alive. I mean, I presumed she was, but I didn't know where she lived, had no contact. And I had been on a number of talk shows and radio call-in programs, and always someone would ask me, some concerned little old lady, you know, from Pasadena would ask me, do you think you'll ever see your daughter again? And, or your son? And I said, well, some weeks I think I'll die before I will, and some days I think they're going to be on the phone tomorrow. And that was one of those days, and she was on the phone. And to make that long story short, we communicated by email and so forth for a year, and then we finally got together, and now we've had three meetings, and it progressively better. I mean, they were really quite good from the beginning. And so there's at least a positive. She's a returning, not a retractor at this point, but there's that positive end of the story. And it turned out that after that first little talk on the telephone, I couldn't help but tell her that I had written this book, and I thought she might hang up the phone on me, but she didn't. And I said, don't read it now. You don't have to. Let's just talk first. Let's communicate first. Well, it turned out within the year, I came to find out that she obviously had gone out and picked that up the next day after our phone conversation. So those are, you know, I don't know how many thousands of books have been sold or whatever, and I don't really care. It's been reviewed well, even though no New York publisher would take it. My agent just said, you're not going to get this. No New York publisher is going to take this, and Mark can speak to that as well. It doesn't matter. What mattered was this letter from Leah Franklin and some other of you beautiful people who have come up to me and said, this book has affected my life. And that's the bottom line.
I always wanted to stand here. My name's Mark Pendergrast. I wrote a book called Victims of Memory. It's the most important thing I'll ever write. I've written some other books that have made me a lot more money, but I continually tell people that this is the most important subject I will ever write about, the most important book I will write. My background is that I was a librarian for many years, and so I'm something of a scholar. I like looking up stuff. I like finding out stuff. I always have. And for 25 years before this had happened to me, I had written freelance articles, and about the time that I lost both of my daughters in the fall of 1992, my first major book was about to come out, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. And so it couldn't have come at a worse time when I was really proud, you know, that I'd finally made it as a full-time author. I'd quit my job. with a lot of trepidation. I'd gone out and then this happened. And I got to tell you, I did not intend to write Victims of Memory. You all know that when this first happens to you, it's devastating. All I could do was cry for weeks. But I pulled myself together, and I decided that the way I was going to deal with this was to use the talents that I had, which was interviewing and research skills. So I began to read everything I could about how human memory worked, and I also began to interview therapists who did recovered memory therapy without telling them about my personal situation, but I wanted to understand how they thought. And I started to interview, I went to an incest survivors meeting and started to interview people who had their memories come back, and it quickly became apparent that this was what was going on. You know, I mean, and these were unbelievable interviews, and many of them are in the middle of my book, and I'm sure many of you have read them. And as I began to realize that this was a widespread phenomenon, an epidemic, I found out about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and I began to read their material. And I thought, good God, I'm in a position where I could write something about this, and I should. And I'll tell you one thing that irritates me more than anything in the world is people who say, oh, this, you know, the people on the other side of this who say, oh, this guy wrote this book to declare his innocence or to say that he didn't do this. Nobody in the whole world would have known anything about this. My children have never made it public unless I had chosen to do this. I was more like declaring my possible guilt rather than my innocence. My editor, my literary agent, everybody said, you're crazy, don't do this. My parents said, if you must do this, don't use your own name. And I said, I have nothing to be ashamed of, and this is something that I'm going to be proud to have done. And they have all come around to realize that that's true. Now, I too, like Reinder, have had people tell me some wonderful things as a result of the book. I continue to hear from people on a once-a-week basis, either by email or telephone or letter, that this book has meant something to them. I think the things that mean the most to me are a young woman who came up to me at a meeting. It was in one of the states where Ellen and I spent an entire unbelievable summer going around the United States together talking. And it was at one of these meetings and staying in all of your homes. It was really quite a remarkable experience. After that meeting, a young woman came up to me and said, I read your book, and I contacted my parents for the first time in 5 years. Now, that is what keeps me going. I mean, I've heard from many parents who said, your book described my life. But it's when I know that I've had that effect, when I actually reunited a family. I had another male retractor come up and say, your book saved my life. Reading your book, I think, saved my life. So it's those kinds of things that are very meaningful. Now, I wanted to go on just briefly and talk about things I think might happen in the future. There's some studies I'd like to see done. They would cost a lot of money. I don't know how in the world to pay for them, but I just want to mention this here because I have the opportunity. I want to know how many people committed suicide because they were under the spell of this therapy or because they fell out of it and they in the guilt of realizing what they had done. I want to know how many parents committed suicide. I am convinced it's far more than 20, which is how many people died as a result of the Salem witch hunts. I want to have some sort of study. I want to hire the Roper organization or the Gallup organization, and this would cost probably $1 million or something. It would be ridiculously expensive, but I want a random study of how many cases there were in this country. How many cases were there? Now, I have been taken to task by all sorts of people for saying in my book that I think that there were several million cases, but I am quite firmly convinced that that's true, that there were probably several million cases of families blown apart by this kind of therapy, mostly between 1988 and 1995 at the height of it. And you can read in the final chapter of my book how I came up with that conclusion, but you can also just by anecdotally, whenever I talk to people about this, about 1 out of 10 people I talk to, this has happened somehow in their family. It is remarkably prevalent. The number of people who have contacted the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is minuscule, minuscule, compared to the number of people who've been affected by this. It takes a lot of courage to pick up that telephone and tell somebody that this has happened to you, and most people don't have that courage. You are a minority who are sitting in this room. I'm convinced of it. This is a phenomenal historical event that you have lived through and that we have been part of and that we have helped to document. This is an unbelievable time in American history, and I hope that it will be better documented than it even has been. I do want to write this book called Recovering from Recovered Memories. I hope Eleanor will help me or somebody will help me. I want to make it a real short book, a self-help book aimed at returnees or and retractors or and their families, because I feel that a book to help people reunite and get through this would be good. I'll feel kind of stupid writing it in a way because my children have not returned at all. I firmly believe that if I live long enough, they will. But I worry about getting run over by a truck. I want to beg you to consider something, and God knows I owe Pam and Peter Fried my sanity, and I'm their personal friends. But Pam, I don't want you to narrow your focus. I want you to broaden your focus, or else I want you to find somebody who I would totally understand if you wanted to go and live on a South Seas island the rest of your life, but I even want you to rename your organization. I mean, I've even come up with a name, FSAAF, the False Sex Abuse Allegation Foundation, or you could call it the FMAF, the False Molestation Allegation Foundation, because we may have won the war, as you've heard, or the battle. We've won the battle against recovered memory therapy by and large. I mean, I'd like to reiterate what Pam and what everybody else has said. The clinical mindset and the clinical mindset is still vastly prevalent out there, vastly prevalent. The people who are searching for ritual abuse, they may be in the hinterlands and craziness, but we haven't won the battle against really bizarre therapy and stupidity. But what we really haven't won, and what predated repressed memories, and what continues to this day, and is worse than it ever has been, are the children's cases. The Child Protective Services is out of control, and there are, and let me tell you, as horrible as it has been for me personally to lose my daughters, I got to raise my children. I got to raise them, I got to love them. I know fundamentally somewhere they love me deep down in their hearts. But these people, and also I'm well educated and I have some resources to fight this. And most of you are in the same boat who've had your children fall prey to repressed memories. The people who have been attacked by the Child Protective Services are by and large undereducated and underfunded and don't know what hit them. Their children are taken away from them at the age of 3 or 4 years old. Their children are traumatized for the rest of their lives. And the people, instead of just being sued in civil court, they're sued in criminal court. They're in prison. Our prisons are chock full of innocent people because of sex abuse allegations. And I would love, and unfortunately, there have been organizations to address this, Vocal, which totally fell apart from what I can understand. Kim Hart runs a pretty good organization out of Ohio, but they're underfunded and overwhelmed. And God Almighty, I just feel personally, having found out, and I wrote a chapter in my book called And a Little Child Shall Lead Them and Be Led, and it's about these cases. And I'm writing about one of these cases right now, and they just don't go away. And I keep getting calls, and I'm pretty sure that Pam gets probably 9 out of 10 calls now is on these children's cases. Now, I know you can't save the whole world, And I know you have to limit yourself. Oh, my time is up. But I hope we'll do that. One more thing I'd like to mention in my vast frustrations in life. I would love to speak to professional organizations about this topic, about any of these topics. It has been very frustrating that Charles Cavanis and Saul Wasserman, when I went to California, they arranged for me to give grand rounds at Stanford University to psychiatrists, and I gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club and things like that. But by and large, it's been astonishing to me that I've written really one of the most comprehensive books and one of the most scholarly books about this subject, and I have been vastly ignored by lawyers, by psychologists, by social workers. So if there's some way you can get me in front of an audience, I need to have my expenses paid, but let me.
One of my heroes, and I watched her go up against a crowd of packed room of zealots at a conference that I had sponsored and brought her to. And I watched her with incredible dignity and reason and ration engage peers. Eventually coming out of the movement and in 1993 forming Project Middle Ground, which had three basic goals to it: education of professionals, the general public, mediation of families with the accusers and the accused, helping them to have a safe place of dialogue, and restoration of retractors post-therapy, restoration of retractors to their families, and then eventually working with returnees in working to restore them to their families as well. And it's been quite a journey. In 1994, we were able to publish, thank you, Holiday and Ralph, for the first national survey of retractors and their experiences. We've had opportunity, and it's been my privilege, to talk to, you name it, hospital folks and professional groups and conferences and colleges and universities and FMS family groups and state chapters, and have just worked anybody who would listen to the issue. And one of my other heroes is my wife Erin, who patiently in these years put up with me going off to all points of the globe watching our two young children, Maisie and Woody, and typically often I would, Dan, you can attest to this, would give my time, you know, Mark, like what you said, pay my airfare and I'm there. And Erin would, you know, understand as we would look at our checkbook. She's one of my heroes. In 1996, put out the book Second Thoughts. And I think some of the unique aspects of that include the story of my journey in coming out of my delusion, my deception, of what I was teaching and practicing with my clients, and what was sort of the process of what I discovered that helped me understand the error of my ways, and then the establishment of Project Middle Ground to make a difference. And I've got to share a story, Eleanor. I've got to. Real quick. Thomas Nelson. The world's biggest Christian publishing house. They do Minerth Meyer's material, if anybody knows the Minerth Meyer clinics. So when I first asked them to consider the book, they turned it down, too politically hot. 6 months later, because of some other reasons, I ran the proposal back by them. And in that period of time, one of the editors that sits on the board, who had been most vehemently against the book Second Thoughts, shared that since they had first considered it a half year before, she had gone through a little bit of depression and had sought out a Christian therapist. And guess what? He told her that everything was related to hidden memories of sexual abuse. Surprise, surprise. She had read my first treatment, you know, and so of the book, and so she laughed, went to another Christian therapist. Guess what? Her depression was related to hidden memories of abuse. And she looked at the board. Now, I heard this later from my editor. And he said, the board was stunned because she was the one, 6 months before, most vehemently against this. She looked at the board and said, we must publish this book, even though Minner's Meyer wouldn't take too nicely to it. Small story. Unique aspects. User-friendly, work to really make it as readable as possible. And it has a crossover feature into the Christian community. And the idea is to speak in the language of the Christian faith effectively. Because from the broader scope, we're making tremendous inroads. But within the Christian community, they're not hearing it because they see it as secular research. And so part of what I work to do in Second Thoughts is to speak in the language of faith, to say, okay, then from a biblical perspective, let's look at this issue as well as scientifically. And frankly, I think it's been very effective. I've gotten a lot of feedback of pastors, Christian counselors, etc., who've been able to get it. Challenges into the future. Unfortunately, within the Christian realm, recovered memory therapy is still flourishing. And when I go, just last week I was at Biola University in LA, and they gave me 2 days to speak to faculty, students. I still find they're at least probably 4 to 5 years behind the regular audiences that I speak to. It feels like literally I'm stepping back in time. Another challenge is picking up the pieces. What is that next step for families? How do you make sense and move on past these things? I know we're short. I want to say, what a journey it's been. What a privilege it has been. I look around and all these faces that I've been able to know these lives. And I tell you truthfully, what a privilege. You are some of the very finest people I have ever known in my life. And to be allowed to enter into your horror, to be given permission to journey with you, it's been an incredible privilege for me. And I thank you for what you've taught me. And I hope that I'm able to make some degree of difference, some good in all that. Thank you very much.
Well, as Mark said, we've had quite a journey through this country. We've seen it like nobody else, being taken into people's homes and treated with caring. And it's like I say, every time we went someplace, it's like, this is my new best friend. I feel as if we become best friends immediately because we share a knowledge of probably the most profound problem I think that has ever taken place. I mean, I know the answers to a lot of questions now about human nature and education and nurturing and caring and the vulnerability of people. I think anybody now can be led to believe anything under certain circumstances, and that is that mind-altering techniques have been unleashed on an unwary public. We just didn't know the power of some of these techniques. Now, if you haven't picked up one of these, please do. It's a story of Bruce Perkins and the Sousas, and it contains a letter from Bruce and from Shirley. I think we're just about out of time or over it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Such a chance, yeah, well.